I mean, I picked up the guitar, you know, played Bob Dylan songs when I was 15. And so I'd always, and I played piano, some hymns, because my father was a minister. Oh, and I took piano lessons when I was 8 and 9. So I guess I'd always sort of played on and off, and I liked to sing, but I had to put a lot of personality in it because I'm not really a singer.
That's Lisa Aldridge.
Well, my story is I just grew up here, and it's been around music all my life. You know, my parents bought us the Beatle records and the Elvis records, and so just grew up on music. And then when I was in middle school, Stax was very hot, and dances. I was old enough to go to a dance, so I was in the chorus, and I was like, and in junior high, I was an extra in a couple of musicals. So I've always been involved in the chorus. I was in the chorus in middle school and the chorus in high school. So it just kind of came naturally.
Elise Clifton, sometimes referred to as Gail.
We owe a lot to Phil Fitzgerald. And some of the early pictures of the Panther Burns are Ross is playing that kit. In fact, one of the most famous Panther Burn pictures that Yvette Roberts took, where you've got Eric Hill playing the trumpet, and then somebody else in the background, and Ross looks like he's about to fall over the drums. Those are my vintage drums, or Phil's vintage drums. So the drums predate the fame of the Clifts.
Elisa's sister, Marcia Clifton. Phil was their stepfather, who provided them with a drum kit and a boathouse.
And he had a boathouse on McKellar Lake. And in his boathouse were his jazz drums from the 40s, Lingerland Radio Kings. And so he knew we were trying to get a band together. So he said, oh, yeah, y'all can go down to the boathouse to practice. So he gave us the keys to the boathouse. And, you know, it was like a little boat slip with the house on top. And so we would lug our instruments down these rickety steps toward the marina dock. And then just plug up in the boathouse and played Phil's drums. We did that probably for, and this was pre-Amy too. We did that for about 2 or 3 months. And then another place we practiced after the boathouse was the Thunderbird Lounge.
And Amy Starks, who Marcia just mentioned.
I was always a singer.
In case you forgot, these are the members of the Clits, the all-female Memphis-based punk band that started up in the late 1970s and has resurfaced in the past decade or so. This season of Beyond Beal tells their story. In this episode, we'll be talking about who the members of the Clits are, where they came from, and what the Clits meant to the women involved in the Memphis punk scene. I'm your host, Emma Jane Hopper, and welcome back. The members of the Clits had a variety of musical abilities and backgrounds. Itara Anavitriva, who you heard last episode, spoke to how that came together from a fan and scholar's perspective.
Some of them are very highly formally musically trained. Some of them are, I picked this up because we needed someone to play it. And they rotate instruments a lot on different songs, depending on who's singing, depending on who wants to play what parts, depending on who wrote what parts for what instruments. And so you end up with this sort of mix of knowledge and inexperience on the instruments, where you have these women who are genuinely very knowledgeable about both the genres they're drawing from and just music in general, who are just sort of experimenting and exploring what sorts of sounds they have available to them with what sorts of instruments they can get their hands on.
The members of the Clits each talked about their family life and how they joined the band in our interviews.
I am a native Memphian. I went to college at the University of Memphis. It was, of course, Memphis State when I started. And I was on the 12-year plan. So by the time I graduated, it was University of Memphis. And I took a theater major first, and then I dropped out of that theater major to be the drummer in the all-girl rock band, The Clits. So I started out as theater, dropped out to be in The Clits, then went back as a journalist, which is what my bachelor's degree is in, and my master's is in library. And so they really kind of all go together, even the theater and punk rock with, you know, little kids, because I don't care about acting crazy or foolish or just getting them excited about, you know, the printed page.
That was Marcia Clifton. Amy Starks, on the other hand, spent her years before the Clits all over the place.
My parents were very liberal. And that's how I got to know Lisa, because her parents were liberals. And back in the 60s and 70s, that was an anomaly here in Memphis. So that's how I got to know her in grade school. We had choir, but it was an Episcopal girls' school. We went to chapel every single day with chapel caps on. So I really got into music, and then my dad gave me his Garcia, and I started taking classical guitar and just, you know, learning how to play guitar. I graduated from high school early and ended up in Boulder going to Naropa Institute and studying under Allen Ginsberg. And then I hitchhiked or got a ride to New York City. I'd been up there. So I lived on St. Mark's Place before going to art school in San Francisco. And unfortunately, about 6 weeks after I started, I got a phone call saying that my father had brain cancer, and it was very upsetting.
Amy didn't end up staying in San Francisco for very long.
And then because I had zero money, we were bankrupted by my father's illness. He had no health insurance, or not very good. And we had to sell everything my dad did to pay the brain surgeon. It was a double whammy. I came back to Memphis in the summer, early summer of 79, and joined the Clits in about June of 79. Then I started going to Memphis State, which is the University of Memphis now, and then I went to the Art Academy.
And here's Lisa Aldridge.
I started playing guitar again. I had learned when I was 15, but I'd written a few songs, like one from when I was 11 years old or 13 or something, young. But I'm just kind of floundering. I didn't know what I was doing. And my father died, and then my mother and my two younger brothers moved to France, Europe. So then the Clits got together, and at the time, it felt like a great sense of purpose.
Elise Clifton spent her time around the Memphis music scene before joining the Clits.
I went to beauty school when I got out of high school. I took 1 year off and was a cocktail waitress because they lowered the drinking age to 18, like the year I graduated, which was crazy. That sidetracked my whole life because I wanted to be a cocktail waitress in Overton Square where all the bands were. So I got an interest in punk rock way before about a year before the Clit even became a thing. So, but yeah, I was just hanging out in Midtown and writing songs. And so then someone offered me a Vox Continental. It's an organ, and it was a 60s vintage organ. So after about 6 months, I became the keyboard player and singer, which was fun because it was fun to have an instrument to go back to keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
Much less intimidating than piano. You can cheat so well with an organ. I mean, you just play one note. It sounds so cool.
The soon-to-be members of the Clits didn't know it yet, but they were about to make history.
Yeah, I think you really have to give credit to the Clits first. Panther Burns second, Randy Band, and there are some others.
This is Ross Johnson of Panther Burns, another punk band on the scene at the time.
Well, the first official punk rock band in Memphis was a group called the Clits, K-L-I-T-Z, and they got started in the spring of 78. So they were the first, and they're the first band to play a gig at the now closed Midtown Saloon. And then there were always what they called all-girl bands, or if you want to be horribly sexist, girlfriend bands.
It seems like the Clits didn't realize how important they would become in the moment either. The band's local legend status came with hindsight. Here's Lisa Aldridge.
It takes on a different meaning now than it did then. At the time, I think, you know, that I don't think that my family necessarily thought that I could be taken seriously. I was kind of a mess, and we didn't sound very good. Just, you know, a lot of drinking and that kind of thing. So, which is why I ended up leaving.
They weren't making money either.
Yeah, that's the problem. I think that nobody really paid the cover charge. I don't remember ever making much money.
But they still got some pretty amazing gigs. This is Marcia Clifton.
Now, Gail and Lisa got to get some gigs at CBGB's because we had went up there to tour with the Cramps, so we had a couple of shows. Lisa and Gail stayed on, and they hung out with the Scrubs, and they spent maybe 2 or 3 weeks still in New York, and that's where they were able to get a couple of shows at CBGB's. I don't know if it was just like an open mic night, but Gail says Madonna was in the audience. She feels like she can totally look out in the audience and see, you know, that person who she was in the early days, which is, you know, it's not beyond the realm of possibility. But now we did go to New York to open for, we got to play at the private party for Mondo Video, which that was very exciting because that was all tied in with Saturday Night Live. They're not ready for primetime players, and they made a movie called Mondo Video. And one of our friends knew them and said, I know just the band to play for this gig. And when that, you know, it's one of those things that you hear our name and they go, okay, say no more. That got us through a lot of doors just with that name.
As an all-female band in the late 70s, the Clits had to face off against misogyny in the punk scene at the time. Lisa didn't believe sexism was the reason they weren't a broader commercial success, though.
Yes, but I can't totally blame the world. I mean, our beat was a bit off. I mean, I hadn't learned how to play rhythm guitar yet. And anyway, we had all the attitude, but I don't know that we had the raw talent ability.
Still, the very existence of the Clits made a statement. Here's Marcia Clifton again.
It still is kind of a man's kind of thing. And so I think people not only were challenged by young women, but young women named the Clits. Young women named the Clits who hung out with Jim Dickinson and Alex Chilton. And then it's like, whoa, we don't know about these girls.
Chris McCoy, whose documentary Antenna is about the Memphis punk scene around the same time as the first run of the Clits, spoke about footage he's seen of one of their impromptu concerts.
They were playing like in the lobby, you know, of the Orpheum. And there were all these people gathered around them, and half the people were like, just, you could see it in their faces, were just amazed that there were these strong, crazy looking women doing crazy music up there. And then there was half the people who were just disgusted that there were these strong, crazy looking women doing crazy music up there, you know? And that's where you want to be as a punk rocker, I think, you know? you're going to react to this music one way or the other.
Itara Anovich-Riva spoke of her impression of the Clits and their relationship with womanhood.
They saw themselves as women who wanted to make music, and they wanted to make music as women, not as, you know, necessarily we're trying to sound like guys so we get taken seriously, so much as, no, I'm a girl. I want to sing about being a girl like I'm a girl, because that is who I am and that is what I want to do.
The legacy of the Clits goes beyond their history as one of the first punk bands on the scene in Memphis. It's also a story about gender relations and how we as a society value women in art. The Clits dealt with plenty of sexism from the world around them, including how their name was chosen. Amy spoke about how she felt about the band's name, which Alex Chilton of the Box Tops and Big Star helped them come up with.
Tell you the truth, I'm a tiny bit offended. And every time I get mad at the Clits in my head, I look at Alex and he's laughing. He's like, get over it. He's like, get over it, Amy. He's get over it. So I'm like, I'm over it, yeah. I'm like, okay, ha-ha, Alex. You don't get the last laugh, but maybe you did. He was very cunning, tongue-in-cheek, and yes, I do think it was slightly manipulative of him. But because we all adored Alex so much, I think we allowed it to happen. In other words, Gail and Marcia and Lisa, they're fine with the Clits. I was the one that said, Alex, really? Really?
Amy wasn't a fan of the name. She considered it a slur and still thinks they should change it.
I hated the Clits name. I hated the name. So they thought the Clits was cute. You know, it was so cute. like, can't we do the Kilt? I couldn't even get on the road. I couldn't even tell my mom the name of it. It was a real slur at that time. It was a slur. I think Alex thought it was cute, and he thought, was hoping it was going to be like a Sex Pistols thing. To me, it was just eh.
Despite their name, for fans today, the Clits are no slur. They broke a glass ceiling and helped start the burgeoning Memphis punk scene in one fell swoop. Here's Chris McCoy.
You know, and it was the bravery that it took to get up there and play in front of people. And, you know, you think we have a sexist culture today? 1979, a bunch of chicks getting up and trying to sing rock and roll in a town like Memphis, where it's all these, like, you know, guitar players and you know, extremely talented musicians who are very much music snobs and very sexist about it, you know? I mean, that was just about the most punk thing of it all, is that they were women and they were going to get up there and sing their songs, and there was nothing you could do about it.
Their first run didn't last very long, though. Lisa Aldridge said that she and Amy both wanted to explore different musical sounds.
But that was sort of the end, right before I left, that Amy said, I've had enough. Can't blame her. But she was like me. It was not what she wanted to do. She wanted to sound pretty and beautiful too.
Lisa also needed a change of pace. She'd been dealing with drug and alcohol issues at the time.
I mean, it got really bad, so I left. I mean, it was kind of like stay and kill yourself by mistake or leave. My mother had come back from Europe and she'd moved to outside of DC in this little Maryland, just the suburbs of DC. And so I went home at 25. And yeah, I got healthy and grew my hair a little bit, got new outfits and started wearing high heels and putting a little makeup on to go out at night. Yeah, I mean, I was in bad shape.
The end of their initial run wasn't the end of the Clits, but first the members would spend nearly three decades pursuing different paths. Lisa started a family and eventually became a teacher.
Well, I got married and had three children. And then after 10 years, I had to dissolve that relationship. I didn't want to ever be a divorcee, but I had to. And so that's when I decided, well, wait, I've always wanted to be a teacher. Even if I don't remember ever thinking that before. Short of when I was 8 years old and used to play school. Anyway, went to Belmont and started that odyssey.
They all stayed in touch over the years, and Lisa and Marcia even had a band together for a little while.
Well, I'd say right after the Clits, Lisa and I did a little thing called Missy and the Men, and I was her drummer, and then we had two other guys in the band. And then my husband and I had a band called the Orbit Tomatoes, which we did that in the late 80s.
Marcia kept playing music, started her own family, and taught as well. Her kid was younger, so she didn't rejoin the band for its 21st century run until later on.
Now, you know, Lisa and Gail got back together in like the mid-2000s, 2005, and put the band back together, and my kids were still young. I had a 4-year-old, so I couldn't devote my time to that. And then there was a little bit of tension between, you know, what kind of direction we wanted the band to go in. And I felt like if we ever got back together again, I wanted it to be more women-centric. I wanted us to be more in charge. And I just didn't feel like that opportunity was going to happen in 2005. So Amy and I both set out. And then, you know, I kind of became a mom and got more into teaching and working. And it really wasn't until 2014 that I participated again as the drummer for the Clits.
Elise went back to college.
Then later when I went back to college, when my kids were growing up and when they finally got in elementary school, I went back to college and I picked art for a degree.
Amy ended up working at the NBC affiliate WMC-TV while she finished her degree.
And so I worked at Channel 5 while I was finishing my art history degree for 6 years.
And got really into yoga.
Well, but I do a lot of yoga and I try to keep my lungs very strong and really work on that because I've abused them. I love it. It saved my life and so many times. I attribute my daughter's great looks to the fact that I was doing yoga all through my pregnancy with her.
They'd all moved on, but they'd be back. Memphis wasn't done with the Clits. Here's Chris McCoy.
Memphis punk rock basically goes back to the Panther Burns and the Clits, like sort of the two poles. You know, everything was really descended from there.
That's why this season of Beyond Beale is all about the Clits. Their impact on the Memphis punk scene is undeniable to fans and musicians, and them being women in a time and on a scene not exactly known for widespread feminism only makes their achievements that much more impressive. In our next episode, we'll explore the legacy and the revival of the Clits. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Beyond Beale, the Mike Curb Institute's Memphis Music History Podcast. If you enjoyed this, then be sure to listen to the rest of our season, an in-depth on the all-female Memphis punk band The Clits, wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to the interviewees featured in today's program, in order of appearance, Lisa Aldridge, Elise Clifton, Marcia Clifton, Amy Starks, Atara Anavitriva, Ross Johnson, and Chris McCoy. Today's episode was written and produced by myself, with production and editing assistance from Sydney Sensing, Priscilla Foreman, Isabella Brewer, Kulan Erdenchemeg, and Kate Cunningham. Eli Matlock was also a producer. Dr. J. Tyler Fritz is our faculty advisor. The audio engineer for this episode was Lena Beach, with assistance from myself. The original music for today's program was created by Cam Napier. Thank you to Betsy John and Shalise Barzani for our cover art. I'm your host, Emma Jane Hopper. Thanks for listening.